Welcome to our paranormal afterlife. This is an Our Paranormal Afterlife remastered episode, and I'm your host Simon Bowne. I've been listening to some of the earliest episodes, and I noticed they contain really amazing information that is still relevant today. I've decided to re-release one episode each week with updated and remastered audio to enhance the listening experience. This week I'm talking to Barbara Bartolome about her two near-death experiences. Her first NDE resulted from a childhood illness at 18 months of age. Her second NDE occurred when she went into cardiac arrest due to a radiology technician's error during a pre-surgery diagnostic procedure in 1987. In this experience, Barbara was able to describe things that happened while she was clinically dead. These observations were confirmed by medical staff.
Hello, Barbara, and welcome to the podcast. Now, you set up IANS in Santa Barbara. Can you tell us about IANS?
Well, my IANS group is part of a large organization that's a worldwide organization. And so I started my group in 2011. And so we've been running for 7 years. We meet monthly and we bring in a guest speaker that comes and talks about death or afterlife or communication with the afterlife or near-death experiences, out-of-body experiences, shared death experiences, so that people that are here in Santa Barbara can, and I draw from all the areas around Santa Barbara. We generally have about 100 people each month that come to the meetings. They can then understand better about death, consciousness, afterlife, and all of the things that that, you know, brings to our lives. And so the IANS organization started up in 1981, and it primarily was dedicated to encouraging scientific research and education on both the physical, psychological, social, and spiritual nature of near-death experiences. And so there were some researchers that got together and decided, Raymond Moody, Kenneth Ring, Bruce Grayson, and others. And they started this group to kind of research NDEs. Well, over the years, it morphed. And besides promoting research and exploration and debate on NDEs, they also started up these local groups. And now they are there are about 50 of them in the United States, and then there are probably 11 or 12 that are outside the U.S., and they are just beginning a new resource for the world. There's going to be online groups as well. So they're actually asking us group leaders to step forward and start leading an online group that anyone anywhere could be part of. So that's going to be pretty new and wonderful in the future here. The IANS organization publishes a peer-reviewed journal of near-death studies. They also do a quarterly newsletter called Vital Signs. And then they hold regularly scheduled conferences once a year. They do a conference that is moved from all over. They've done Hawaii. I think they've done it overseas before. They generally jump from the West Coast to the East Coast of the U.S. or in the middle of the U.S. so that people in different areas can have access to it at least once, you know, within a 10-year range. It will be somewhere near you. So I think that's wonderful that they don't just stay in one city every year. And they really support near-death experiencers now. They've really expanded to where they feel that the near-death experiencers really need to have that support through those local groups, as well as the publications that IANS puts out and the website that has so much information on it. It's www.iands.org. And so that's a resource for everyone everywhere. And the conferences are really amazing because you can actually go and not only meet other experiencers, which is why I went to my first conference in 2009. I was invited by a researcher to go to the conference in San Diego. And my big joy was that, oh my gosh, I've never met anyone in my life that has had a near-death experience like me. And so I want to meet someone else. Well, I got to meet at that conference probably 70 near-death experiencers. And we all sat in a circle and got to know one another and told our near-death experiences, maybe a 5-minute, just a little short story about our near-death experiences. And then we got to talk with people one-on-one as we went through the 4-day conference. And it was life-changing for me. I would never miss a near-death experience conference again with IONS, because not only did I get to meet major near-death experiencers like Eben Alexander and Anita Morjani and Jeff Olson and Dr. Mary Neal, but I also got to meet the common normal people like me, and I became friends with all of them. And I can't tell you what a family it feels like to have those people just a phone call or an email away. And it's just pretty awesome.
So can you tell us, what is a near-death experience?
Sure. Well, the IONS website basically describes it as a profound psychological event that may occur to a person who's physically died or is close to death or is not even near death, but is in a situation of physical or emotional crisis. So because it includes transcendental and mystical elements, it's a powerful event of consciousness, not a mental illness. And they state that pretty strongly. It is not a mental illness. So when it's happening in truly near-death experiences, it's pretty amazing, because the out-of-body experience and the vivid perceptions that you encounter during a near-death experience, all of the different things that occur are pretty much similar across the world. All the near-death experiencers anywhere, no matter what religion, what age, what nationality, you know, what sex they are, whether they're a child, whether they're 90-year-old, it's really funny that they've actually been able to classify these certain things that are all occurring amongst these near-death experiencers, although they may be a little different and not consistent. Like one person may not have a tunnel, and like I did not specifically have a tunnel, but I felt an entity when I was on the other side. So there's these different aspects of it that can be included. Mostly the people that have near-death experiences, 80% of them just rise above their body, and then they watch the outcome of their body being resuscitated, whether in a car accident or in a medical environment. And then they are put back down into their body again, either told that they have to go back or, asking to go back because of usually children, taking care of children, or some commitment that they have that they feel the need to go back in and finish that commitment. And so they're only about the 20% of people are the ones that have these extensive near-death experiences that these major books are written about, like Proof of Heaven with Eben Alexander, and Dr. Mary Neal's books, and Jeffrey Long's books as well. Those are books where the person's had the full encounters of going through a tunnel, being in a different location, like a heaven-like place, talking with unfamiliar entities, or they're people of their that they actually know that have passed over, or spiritual presences. And sometimes there's a life review where they check their life out to see, you know, what things they've done. And there's no judgment from someone else. It's more of a feeling of how you are doing and how you're affecting other people and how they feel when you're interacting with them in either positive or negative ways. You feel what they feel. And sometimes, you know, it's also a sense of overpowering knowledge that's given to the person of the history of the world or what the future is going to be. And sometimes also a purpose that's shown to them, that they are in a life to complete a purpose. So there are thousands of documented cases now, and they basically challenge the assumptions of mainstream psychology and medicine and philosophy. And so we're coming along with the acceptance of them. I even see a big change over the last 7 years. And the reason why I say that is that I just had a speaker that came from Missouri to Santa Barbara for my IONS group, Dr. John Hagen. He wrote the book, The Science of Near-Death Experiences. And I had him as a speaker at my IONS group. And then I was able to actually schedule him into a Grand Rounds talk, which is a presentation at my local hospital that was attended by doctors, nurses, and medical professionals, where he spoke about near-death experiences and the science that supports them. And I've never been able to crack the hospital or most of the churches, actually. They just won't let the experiencers in to talk about their experiences. And I'm not sure if it's fear or I don't know what, but oftentimes it's just a closed door. But I'm seeing now as we move forward, I was asked to speak at a hospital in Oregon. I was also asked to speak at a church in Oregon and welcomed very warmly. So I think that the doors are starting to open and media is covering it well. So enough of these are out there in the world and on the internet and YouTube that I think people are starting to guess that this is something very real and that they need to look at it a little bit more closely.
Well, there is so much information out there and there have been so many studies done. It is almost undeniable what is going on, but there are so many people that just don't get exposed to the information. Also, there are a lot of people out there who just refuse to listen.
Yeah.
They stick their fingers in their ears and say they can't hear you.
Exactly. They're finding that like 15% of people who go into cardiac arrest, the reason why we have more and more NDEs is because our medical procedures have improved to the point where someone going into cardiac arrest can be brought back again. And so resuscitation improvements have caused near-death experiencers to multiply all over the world. Even just CPR, you know, 50 years ago, they didn't have CPR. CPR, cardiopulmonary resuscitation, that, you know, thump on the chest and the breathing in the mouth and the pressing on the lungs and the heart area, that is causing people to come back from situations that they would have been staying dead at. So it's interesting that we're now coming back to a greater extent and we're getting more and more comfortable about reporting them. When I had mine in 1987, I'd never even heard of a near-death experience. I'd never even known that anything like that could happen. I knew nothing.
So could you tell us about your near-death experience?
Yeah. In 1987, I was 31 years old and I was married and I had two children. I had an 8-year-old son and a 5-month-old baby daughter. And I had about a month after my birth of my baby, I had lifted something too heavy and I had ruptured a disc in my lower back. And so when I went to the first doctor, he said, "I'm sorry, but it can't be repaired and you're going to be in a wheelchair for life." And I was 31 years old and said, "What?" And so I went to another doctor and it was a neurosurgeon. And he looked at all my tests that had been done and he said, "No, I can fix this." So I just absolutely wanted to believe him. So he scheduled a surgery that was called the laminectomy discectomy, where they were going to clean up the fragments of the shattered disc. And they were going to go into the area where the disc had blown. And the night before that surgery, the two doctors, he brought on an orthopedic surgeon. So now it was going to be a team, neurosurgeon, orthopedic surgeon team that was going to do the surgery in the morning. But they wanted to do a test the night before that they were going to check to see if my spinal cord had been hit by one of the disc fragments because they were concerned that I might be leaking spinal fluid and that might be causing, you know, additional problems besides the disc being blown. So they scheduled the test the night before after I checked into the hospital. I was sent over to the x-ray area and they prepped me for what's called a myelogram. And they explained to me they were injecting iodine dye into my spinal cord at the base of my neck. And that I was to hold very, very still on the x-ray table because if I moved, I would have headaches for months afterwards. So luckily, the neurosurgeon and the orthopedic surgeon joined the x-ray team in the room. And I believe back then it was probably because they wouldn't have had time to get the results of the myelogram to them before the 7 a.m. surgery the next morning. So the team of two doctors were in the room, two x-ray technicians, and a nurse. As I was laying on the table, the x-ray technician that was standing right next to the table started moving the table with a button that he had his finger on. The other x-ray tech was in front of a monitor, and he was going to be watching as the dye went down my spinal cord, and when it got to the right area, he would be taking pictures of that area to see if there was any flowing of the dye out of my spinal cord. So as the table was moving, I immediately started noticing that I was feeling very weird. And I thought, I wonder if I'm supposed to feel like this. But the two x-ray techs were talking to each other and I didn't want to interrupt them. So as the table was tipping more and more, I was feeling weirder and weirder. And I was feeling as though I was going to faint. So finally, I thought, you know, I should probably say something to them. I don't know if I'm supposed to be feeling like this. But when I went to speak, I realized I couldn't say anything. I could think things in my head, but I couldn't figure out how to open my mouth to say anything. And I couldn't move my hands or my feet or anything. I was basically laying there, you know, frozen because my brain was having a problem. And the reason why the problem was occurring was that the x-ray tech didn't notice that he had his finger on the wrong button on the x-ray machine, and he was actually lowering my head instead of raising it. So the dye that they just injected at the base of my skull was going right into my brain and changing the pressure on my brain, which was causing me to have malfunctioning of my brain. And finally, the very end of the 3 minutes or so that this was occurring, I started hyperventilating, and that caused the x-ray tech next to me to hear me. I was, you know, going very fast and my eyes were rolling to the back of my head. And so he leaned over me to see what was wrong. And when he saw that my eyes were rolling back and that I was hyperventilating, he leaned back to see where his thumb was. And then he had this look of, you know, absolute scared and shock and, oh no, oh my God. And right at that point, my eyes shut, and it was no more strange than just shutting your eyes. And the next second when I opened my eyes, I was up on the ceiling, felt like there was a presence of my head up there. I didn't look to see if I had a body, but I literally did feel there was something that my back of my head was against, like the ceiling. And I was looking straight down at my body and the top of everyone's heads and the top of the equipment and everything. And I had been panicking in my body, feeling very scared because I was hyperventilating. And when I got up on the ceiling the next second, I was absolutely calm and it was completely peaceful. I looked down and I literally said to myself, huh, if I'm up here and my body's down there and that man is calling code blue, I think I might have just died. And there was no, oh no, you know, oh no, I need to go back. There was nothing like that at all. It was absolutely calm and absolutely okay. And the second that I said that, I felt a presence next to me on the ceiling. And it felt so incredibly immense, so knowing of who I was, so connected to me from the first point of eternity all the way to the future end of eternity. I literally felt this presence, and I knew that they were like, it seemed to me that's who God was. And so I then communicated with this being, and it was simply clear through thoughts. It wasn't, you know, I didn't have a mouth. I wasn't speaking. But I said, oh, I would really like to go back. If I leave my children in this way at this time, they won't grow up to be the human beings that they could be if I contribute to them. I would really like to go back. And over the course of maybe 8 minutes or so that I was dead, I said that about four different times. I also immediately knew when I was out of my body that I had a particular life purpose that I had not completed yet, and I knew exactly what it was. Now, whether I set that life purpose or whether it was set for me, I have no idea, but I, up on the ceiling, knew what my life purpose was and that I had not done it. So I also said to the being, I would like to return to complete my life purpose. And so down below, they had started CPR. Both the x-ray techs were doing the CPR. The nurse was on the phone calling for a defibrillation machine to restart my heart. And she was kind of panicking and yelling stats and all that means hurry up now. And there was a lot of noise and a lot of action down below. And I felt it was obnoxious. It literally felt very loud, very, I don't know, just.
Was it chaotic?
It was. It was. And I didn't even, I was watching it, but it felt awful, actually. All the stuff down below was awful compared to what I was experiencing with this being and the sensitive, gentle and kind and loving nature I was feeling from this being. So even though I kept my eyes on and watched what was going on down below as I talked to the being, it did seem obnoxious down below. And one of the things that happened was that they had called for a heart monitor, and a man came into the room. First, a woman came into the room with an oxygen card and put an oxygen mask on my face. And then a couple, maybe a minute or so later, a man came in and he brought in a small box. And I actually didn't know what it was he was doing because he started peeling off these little backings to these white circles, and the man was putting them on my chest, above my breasts, in my chest area. And as I was watching him do that, I had understood everything else that was going on down below, but I didn't understand what he was doing. And so I just kind of casually asked the being, what is that he's doing? And when I asked that question, I was moved from the ceiling vantage point above my body, right down in front of the box that was on a ledge next to my body that was laying on the x-ray table. There was a ledge, and this box was there. And I was right in front of the box as if, you know, it was like 5 inches from my eyes. And there was a glass area of it, and it was greenish. And I remember seeing the man's hand flick a little toggle switch on the side of the box. And when he did that, a green light lit up in the green glass area, and it went straight across the screen, and the box was making this monotone sound. Well, I've never had much medical stuff happen, and I have never been a person who watches much TV, and I didn't know what it was. And I was watching the little green light go straight across the screen, and the monotone sound is going beep. And so I watched it go across, and then it started again on the left side, and it went across the screen a second time, and I watched it, and I was still trying to figure out, what is this? And the third time it started to go across, I realized, oh, I think that is supposed to be making patterns up and down because it's supposed to be showing my heart. Oh, my heart has stopped. And the second that I thought that, I was moved back up onto the ceiling, and the being was still there. It was like I had been shown what I asked for, which was, what is that he's doing? Until I figured it out, I was down there watching the heart monitor until I figured it out. And then I was moved back up on the ceiling again. So that was pretty awesome. And then it just continued for about 8 to 10 minutes with me saying in various ways how much I wanted to go back into my life. And at the very end of the time that I was had my heart stopped, the two doctors talked to each other, and one of the doctors said to the other, too much time is passing. She's going to have brain damage. We need to do something. You know, defib unit hadn't been brought in yet. And so the neurosurgeon stayed back, but the orthopedic surgeon said, stand clear, to the two x-ray techs who are doing the CPR. And he stepped 2 steps forward, took his fist from behind his back arched it from behind his back over his head and pounded the center of my body on the x-ray table right where my chest is. And when he did that, I watched my body react to that blow and nothing happened. I didn't go back in my body, but the being up there on the ceiling finally said something to me. And in this very calm voice, it was just beautiful. He said, "But if you go back, you'll still be in your marriage. What will you do?" And then I was shown these little pieces of incidents that had happened in my marriage because I was married to someone who was very angry. And he, I think it was early childhood things that had happened to him, but he just took his anger out all the time on me and on our children. And I was constantly trying to keep him in a balanced mode and do everything his way so that he wouldn't be angry. And I had been living that way for a, you know, number of years. And so I then was shown all of these incidents where he had hit me, he had berated me, he had abused me. All these different things were shown in little flashes so that I would remember all of the things that I had been forgetting and forgiving, more seeing a full picture of what I was living with.
Did you feel the presence was giving you a choice to go back to your body or stay?
Yes, absolutely. Then after I saw those little film clips of all that stuff, then it was kind of not told to me, but I felt that I had all the time that I needed to make a decision of whether I wanted to stay or whether I wanted to come back. And so I evaluated my relationship with my husband up there on the ceiling. This was right after the precordial thump, which is when he struck my chest, and before the next one, which was seconds later. Time up on the ceiling spread out, and it was like there wasn't any time. I was able to do, you know, evaluate my current situation, and I thought about all the things I had done to try to help my husband move past his anger issues, and I had taken him to a counselor, I had taken him to a church pastor, and he had rejected all of the things that I had tried to get him, you know, to help him with. And so I thought about all of the things I'd done and what I was living with. And I then ended up concluding that there wasn't going to be a way that I was going to change this person, that it was really better for me to leave and go into a different life, to move on. And so I said to the being, "If you let me go back, I promise you, I'll get strong enough to leave him." Because I had been really diminished by the abusive relationship over the course of the years that I'd been in it. And I realized that I needed to build my strength up to get strong enough to go. So when I said that, "If you let me go back, I promise you I'll get strong enough to leave him," the second I said that, then I literally shut my eyes on the ceiling and found myself blinking my eyes open, and the doctor's fist, he had just hit me for the second time, and his fist was still on my chest, and I was looking straight up his arm into his face, and I blinked my eyes open. I had the oxygen mask on my face, and I said, "What just happened?" And the nurse next to the doctor said, "Don't talk. Stop. Don't talk. We need to stabilize you." So for 20 minutes, I sat there with the oxygen mask on, looking at all the people's faces in the room, knowing that I had just been up on the ceiling, knowing I had just had that experience with that being, watching the whole room, feeling I had been not lost one second of consciousness in that whole thing. And I was like, "Oh my gosh, what was that?" And so when they finally took the oxygen mask off 20 minutes later, everybody in the room was waiting to see what I was going to say, since I had, you know, kind of clued them in when I said, "What just happened?" And with such astonishment in my voice. And so when they took the oxygen mask off, I said, "What just happened?" I was up on the ceiling the entire time. I could see and hear all of you. And the neurosurgeon was standing next to the table, and he said, "Oh, brother," which was, as far as I can see in my life, the best thing that he could have said.
You seem so sarcastic.
He was. He was like, oh, brother. But that was the perfect thing to say to me, because being 31 years old and having just had that experience, I just blurted out everything that had just unfolded down below. She was the person who brought in the oxygen cart and put it on my face. That man brought in a heart monitor. I watched it flatlining, and I could hear it making that monotone sound. And that woman was on the phone the whole time, and she was calling for the defib unit, but it never came in. And he was doing CPR with you, and I watched that until you said this to him. And I told the doctors what they had said in their conversation. And I said, then you stepped forward and two steps and struck my chest twice, and then I came back. And I completely validated my entire NDE. And they, of course, were all when I was saying all that, the neurosurgeon, he was right next to the table. I watched him, his hands were clenched and they started shaking. And he had this clenched, and then he had his teeth kind of clenched. And then when I stopped, he said, I'm not going to stand here and listen to this. And he stormed out of the room.
It sounds like you really freaked him out and challenged his beliefs on this.
I totally did. And the other people in the room, they all stayed. And then the orthopedic surgeon, he asked me questions like, what did you feel? And what did you see? And how did you, what did you hear? And what did you see down below? And he asked me questions. So I literally validated in front of all those people. But then when they moved me onto a gurney and they took me up to my private room, they were going to do the surgery the next day. There was not one single person in that hospital that would talk to me about what had happened. I kept saying, what happened during my myelogram? Could you tell me what was that? Why was I on the ceiling? And they would look at my chart and say, well, I don't know what you're talking about. I'm sorry, there's nothing here. And so when the doctors came in after I had done, they did the surgery anyway the next morning, even though they killed me the night before, they did the surgery, which was very beneficial to my back in the long run. But they came in to my room to explain to me after I'd gotten out of recovery and everything. They wanted to tell me that surgery had been successful and what they'd found. And when they came in the room and I tried to ask them something, they said, we're not here to talk to you about that. We're here to talk to you about your surgery. And then they went back on the track of surgery again. So I left the hospital like 4 days later. By the way, when my husband came that day of the surgery to see me, he brought my baby daughter and my son. And when I told him what happened during the near-death experience, he looked at me and he said, that couldn't have happened. You probably hallucinated that. And that was really a blow to me, because my mom was a police officer, and I literally made a decision before I was 21 years old. I tried alcohol a couple times and I thought it was terrible. And so I literally have never drank my whole life. I never did any drugs of any kind. I literally, if there's medicines to take, I'm like really careful and I try to do natural things. And I couldn't believe that he said that I had hallucinated it. And why would I hallucinate it? So I clammed up about it after I got out of the hospital, and I didn't talk about it for 13 years. I didn't research it. There was no internet at that time. And so I kind of just buried it inside me. It was still very clear, though. The amazing part was, if I ever thought about it, something triggered it to make me think about it, then it was so clear. It was the clearest memory I had in my entire life. And I could actually think about it and shut my eyes and look down to see where people's heads were and where the table was in the room and where I could draw the room from up above. I mean, it was pretty amazing how clear it was, but I had no one to talk to. And so I left it alone for all those years. It wasn't part of me. I didn't assimilate it into my life until later.
You did have after effects to do with intuition and psychic visions?
Yes, definitely. I didn't know they were after effects. And not until I connected with the IANS organization in that very first conference I went to in 2011 in San Diego, the theme of that conference was after effects of near-death experiences. And I had not known that, what the theme was or anything. I was just invited by one of the researchers to go. And so as the very first night I was there, I looked up the researcher that had asked me to go, and I found him and his wife. And so I was standing next to them as they were talking. He's a doctor, And I was standing next to them as they were talking to other high-level people within the organization of IONS and researchers that are, you know, with universities and stuff. And they were talking about the after effects of this conversation. And I'd never heard that there were after effects. So this was the first time I was opened up to this. And as they were talking about them, I was standing there next to this researcher. His name is Dr. Jeffrey Long, and he runs the Near Death Experience Research Foundation, which is www.nderf.org. And when I was listening to him and his conversations with these other people, I was sitting there thinking, wait a minute, I have that as an after effect. I totally can identify with that. But what's so weird is that goes all the way back to my early childhood, specifically when they were talking about the intuition that near-death experiencers gain and how, like, Mike's experiences that I've had all through my life, with basically knowing something that's going to happen, or, you know, knowing things beyond what you should know. And so I then was disconcerted, because when they were talking about that, I thought, why are they saying that these things are after effects to a near-death experience? And there was a woman standing next to me that I had no idea who she was. And I turned to her and I said, you know, I just don't understand. You're saying that these after effects are from a near-death experience, but I can identify with them being all the time in my life, even before my near-death experience. So why would that be? And she took my hands. It happened to be PMH Atwater, who's written numerous books on near-death experiences. She's a major researcher. And she took my hands and she said, my dear, I think that if you had those specific after effects that we've been talking about much, you know, before your near-death experience, you should talk with your family to see if something happened to you when you were young, because you probably had some sort of an experience when you were young that you may not know about. And I have to admit, and I told her this, I thought, oh, brother, people think that I had more than one of these? And I was pretty shocked, and I thought, that's absurd. But as I was going through the conference, it was 4 days long, and as I was listening to different speakers and stuff, I kept thinking about that, and something kept coming back to me from my early childhood. My mom was a very strong woman and about 5'10" and very powerful. And she had 5 children, and she was a powerhouse. And when she would get like soft with me, which wasn't very often, like brushing my hair, there were about 4 times that I can remember where she made a statement that I never could identify with. And I didn't know why she was saying it. And I never asked her. She's deceased now. And so she said, you know, I'm really glad that you stayed with us. We thought we'd lost you at one point, but I'm glad that you stayed. And I never knew what she was talking about. I thought, did I get lost someplace? Did I, you know, when I was a child, did she lose me? I didn't know what that meant. And I was up until maybe about age 16 that she said this. So I never thought about asking her, what did you mean by that? And then, of course, she had died later on. So I thought about that, and I thought, you know, maybe my older brother, who's 10 years older than me, might know more about what this, you know, what this is. So I didn't want to tell him. I hadn't told any of my family about my near-death experience, and I didn't want to release that information to him and color his vision on why I might be asking, you know, a question. So I said to my older brother, I'm doing an entire life medical history, and I'm going to go all the way back to my birth. And I remember certain things that happened where I fell off the jungle gym, and I, you know, twisted my ankle on another event, and I hurt my arm on another event. Do you remember anything else that I did that I should put on my medical, you know, records? And my brother said, I don't know. I'll have to think about that. And he ended up talking to me later on, and he said, you know, Barb, I need to apologize to you. There's something that I should have told you earlier in your life. But every time I thought about talking to you about it, it either wasn't a good time in your life for you to hear it, or it wasn't a good time in my life for me to tell it. And he said, when you were 18 months old, you were very sick with some flu or childhood illness. You had a very high fever. I'm thinking about 106 degrees. And he said, Mom was taking care of you. She was pregnant with our youngest sibling who was ready to be born. And I guess that I, as my mom was trying to keep my fever down, I went into convulsions and I stopped breathing. So my mom screamed for my dad to call the fire department. It was 1958, and there was no 911 back then, which is the emergency call number. And so my father called the fire department, and they told him to have my mom put me into a bathtub with tepid bath water, and that they could slowly then add ice cubes to slowly lower my body temperature. So they were sending the ambulance over, and they wanted them to do that before the ambulance got there. So my mom sent my brother, the one that I was talking to, into the freezer, and there was only one tray of ice cubes. It was 1958. We didn't have ice makers. And so my brother and his younger brother, my other brother, was sent over to our neighbor's houses to collect ice. And so my brother was gone, he said, 8 to 10 minutes collecting ice from the neighbor. When he got back, he said that he saw that I was bluish purple, that I had not shown any sign of life, that my mom was sobbing over me, holding me in the bath water. And he handed my mom the ice, and she started adding some ice to the bath water, sobbing. And my dad was on the phone screaming, "It's a fire department." And melee was occurring. And he said, all of a sudden, he heard the ambulance approaching our home and stopped out in front of our house. And he could hear the siren winding down. And he said, all of a sudden, he said, "You just took this deep breath and came back to life." He said, "You changed from purplish to bright red because you were still feverish." And he said, "You start crying." And he said, "I've never been so happy. I knew you were alive again." And he said the ambulance people came in and rushed me off to the hospital. And my older sister remembers the event as well. I haven't spoken with my other brother about it, but two of my siblings remember the event. And they were told afterwards, she was 6 years old and my older brother was 12 years old. They were told never to talk about it again. My parents didn't want to ever speak about it. And so that's why it was hidden from me. I'm pretty darn sure that that was a near-death experience, because all of those after effects were very prevalent through my early life. And my mom actually was very scared of them. So when I would have an intuitive moment, like an example, I'm standing on the street corner at 5 years old, holding my mom's hand. My little sister is holding her other hand. She's 3 years old at the time. And all of a sudden, I break my mom's grip and I put my hands over my face. And my mom is kind of a no-nonsense person. She looks down at me and says, "What are you doing?" And I peek through my hands and say, "They're going to crash." And right then, a car runs the red light and slams into the side of a car going through the green light. And they crash right in the intersection in front of us. And my mom let go of my little sister's hand and grabbed me with both shoulders and shook me and said, "Don't ever do that again. Don't tell anyone you can do that." So it was very upsetting to her that anything like that ever came out. So I learned to hide it and not talk about it and, you know, keep it under wraps. But it happened a lot. And I knew that it was weird. And I was actually scared of it because I didn't have anybody to talk to about it. And I didn't know why it happened to me and not my little sister and not my other people in my family. And so it was very hard. It was hard to grow up with that and keep it under wraps. But now I actually celebrate it when it happens. I'm happy that I'm connected to the other side and that I realize that it's a gift and that it's valuable. And so it's actually saved my life. And I actually, yeah.
Is it that most people who have near-death experiences have these after effects?
Yes, intuition is a really strong one with near-death experiencers, as well as a number of other after effects that are very documented on the IANS website. And they include sensitivity to sound and light. I never as a teenager could go to a rock concert. I went to one at one point and I had to ask my date to let me leave because, you know, said I need to leave because I couldn't stand the loud music at the concert. Other things are feeling an overwhelming sense of peace and joy in your life, and knowing that you're here for a reason, and that you you love and accept others very much more than normal people usually do. You feel kind of the importance of telling others about death, the reality of death, not what we're taught, but what the reality is, and also about God or Source and the importance of that and the power of love here on earth and how important it is to forgive and love people. You know, some of the physical things are, I have a really lower blood pressure, and I've always had, the doctors used to be really weird with me and say, wow, your blood pressure is really low. I don't have any negative effects from it. I just have a really low blood pressure. And I never knew that that was one of the side effects from a near-death experience. And also my vision and my hearing are really, really perfect. And in fact, that Dr. John Hagen that was just here is a board certified ophthalmologist that does surgeries on eyes. And he was talking to me about vision, and I said, you know, it's really interesting. I just had my vision check and I have 20/20 vision. I'm 62 years old. And he said, wow, that is great. And I said, what's weird is I also can see the tiniest and read the tiniest little things. My husband was always shocked that I'm able to read the smallest little print. And he said, well, that doesn't make any sense. He said, you shouldn't have that. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, if you have 20/20 vision, the way that your eye works, you should not be able to see the very small print. And I said, well, I can't. He literally whipped out his iPhone, got to a vision chart and said, what's the smallest line that you can read on there? And I accurately read the lowest line, the smallest print. And he said, I really like to examine your eyes. He said, I think this is an after effect of your near-death experience. And I was like, well, great. So, you know, it's interesting. The things that I find are I think everything is a positive after my near-death experience. I feel very happy and gifted that it happened to me. I see the world differently. I love the fact that I got blessed with this, and I really see the purpose of my life being talking about it. I realize I've figured out what my purpose is, which is what, you know, I knew up there on the ceiling when I was in my near-death experience in 1987, I am supposed to talk about this. I am supposed to be speaking with the world and telling people and honestly recounting what happened and let people make their own decisions on it. I'm not making anyone believe anything, but I'm telling the truth on what happened to me and hopefully it'll help.
Can you tell us about your past life regression?
My near-death experience was a big, giant article in the newspaper here in Santa Barbara. Five people came forward and said, I want to help you with this group. And one of them was trained by the Monroe Institute on the East Coast of the United States, and he is a past life regression therapist. And that was, besides my near-death experience, the most life-changing experience in my life to have that past life regression. It totally showed me why I had felt in certain ways from my youth all the way to now. I actually saw the connections as to that's why, because I came from a family that my grandmother was very prejudiced, and she had been pulled out of her car by three young black men, and she was hurt a little bit, but not badly, and her purse was stolen. And so she had a very strong negative aspect on black people. And ever since I was a little tiny three-year-old, I was absolutely loving towards everybody. And I had always had this open feeling that everybody was the same. And I couldn't get her to understand that. And when I had my near-death experience, I was actually a little black girl over in a African village, and slave traders came storming into the village, and the village went, you know, started running and panicking. And I got separated from my parents. I was about 9 years old, and I ended up getting captured, and they only took about five children, but I was one of the five. And I ended up on a plantation in the deep South, and people that were on the plantation that were Black. There were a couple there that were trusted by the people who owned the house, and they ended up becoming like my extra parents, and they kind of adopted me. And it was really amazing to see that life, and then to see the people that were in my current life that were actually the mother and father in that previous life. They actually are in my current life now. And one of them has passed away, but it's so amazing to see those connections and understand that that's life changing. I wish everyone would go through a past life regression or 50 of them until they got it, because it is the like a near death experience. It is absolutely life changing. I'm the best salesperson for you in the world, because I am so excited about past life regressions as well, because it was really a gift for me, just like my near-death experience was.
Now, you had an amazing experience with some form of spirit communication. Can you tell us about that?
I had a talk up at IANS in San Francisco that I was doing four different IANS groups. And so my husband and I had driven up there. It's one of the pieces where, you know, I know that the other side is with us and wants to make impacts and help us in our life. And, you know, when we're not even realizing that they're there, they can step in and make a change to an outcome. And oh my God, it was the most amazing story. I can't even tell you. It was June 25th, 2015. And we were driving back from San Francisco after those four speaking engagements. And the way that the highway comes from the north in the coast of California, it's Highway 101. It is inland until it hits what's called Gaviota. And then the highway turns south and runs along the ocean. And so it was about 9:30 at night. And my husband was driving, and I had relaxed backwards in my seat and had my seat tipped back and had my feet, my socks on, up on my dashboard of my van. And we have a Toyota van. And so I was relaxing and my husband was driving, and we came around the corner and started going parallel to the ocean. And this huge gust of wind, probably 60, 70 miles an hour, hit the van. And of course, when we were inland, we couldn't tell that was happening over on the coast. And so it hit the van, and I watched my husband like struggling with the steering wheel. And I said to him, you know, I don't think that we should do 70. If we're going to have gusts of wind that big, Victor, we could lose control. Why don't we slow down to 50? And he said, yeah, I think that's a good idea. And so he slowed down, and I was still leaning backwards. And I thought, I'm safe now. We're okay. We're doing slower speed. And about 5 minutes later, I'm just looking out towards the ocean, and it's beautiful. And there's a bit of a moon rising, and this voice in my right ear on the ocean side, goes, danger, big impact ahead, danger, big impact. And I like, didn't know what to think or do. I've heard the voices before, but never in that kind of a situation. It's always been more of intuition and kind of a clairsentience, like feeling of something was going to happen. And so I sat up in my seat and pulled my seat back up. And then I put my feet on the floor, of course, and checked my seatbelt, make sure I was nice and tight in the seat in case we hit something. And then I said, I got to tell Victor. And so I turned to Victor and I said, you know how I sometimes hear from the other side? And he said, yes. And I said, well, I just heard danger, big impact ahead, danger, big impact. And I said, so something very dangerous is up ahead. We need to slow down more. We need to do 30 miles an hour. And he looked at me and he goes, Barbara, we're on the freeway. And when he said that, I turned and looked behind us and said, Victor, there are no cars behind us right now, so no one's going to care whether we're doing 30 miles an hour. I said, we have something up ahead of us that's very dangerous. They wouldn't have told me that unless it was. And I said, so let's do 30 miles an hour. If you see some car lights coming, go ahead and speed up to 50 until they pass you, and then slow back down to 30 because something dangerous is up there. So he said, okay, that makes sense. We can do that. So we're going along at 30 miles an hour, and about maybe another 5 to 10 minutes later, we come around a bend in the road. we're still running along the ocean and the wind is still buffeting the car. And we see a police car's lights way up ahead in the distance. And it's kind of a straightaway right along that area. And I immediately had that clairsentience, the feeling right in my upper chest that that was where the danger was. And so I was on high alert, and I was, as we were, you know, 30 miles an hour in the slow lane approaching the police car, the first thing I noticed was, oh, weird. How weird is that? He is not parked off the freeway. The cop car is stopped in the slow lane, blocking the slow lane. So then I thought, why would he do that? I've never seen anything like that before. And so then as we were getting closer to it, I realized, wait a minute, there's no policeman in the car. And within the range of his lights from on top, there's no human beings in the area. There's no one to be seen. And that seemed very odd. And so we were coming up behind the police car, and Victor changed lanes to go into the fast lane to go around the police car. And just as he did that, somebody from the other side, I don't know if you want to call it, you know, your angel or your soul guide or whatever, whoever it might have been, grabbed both of my upper arms. I literally felt them grab my upper arms, and I felt their face nose to nose with me. And it was so scary. And then they screamed 10 miles an hour at me. And I screamed at Victor, repeated it. I said, 10 miles an hour to Victor. And he slowed down so that right as we got level with the police car, with our car, we were doing 10 miles an hour. And just as we rolled past it, just maybe 20 feet beyond the police car, when our lights then lit up, the semi-truck that had tipped over on its side and just the bottom of the truck was facing us. The cab of the truck was in the fast lane. Middle of the truck was in the slow lane, 50 to 100 yards in front of the police officer's car. And then the rest of the truck was off the freeway into the gravel towards the ocean. And because we were only doing 10 miles an hour and we were in the fast lane, Victor was able to just slowly go around into the gravel on the left-hand side and go around the front of the truck. And I literally went into shock. I felt my whole body go into shock. And I, as on the far side of the truck, as we cleared the truck, I looked over on the right-hand side of the car out the window, and there was the police officer up on top of the truck checking on the status of the truck driver. And so if we had hit the cab of the truck, that's usually where those gas tanks are, doing, you know, 50, 60, 70 miles an hour, whatever we would have been doing, we probably would have killed both of them. And so really, I spent the next 10 minutes in silence thanking the other side and saying, you know, I'm here for your purposes. It just, you know, when I can help someone, place someone in front of me and give me the resources to help them, and I'm here to do your work and until you want me to come back home again. And so I was busy saying that for about 10 minutes, and it was complete silence in our car. Victor had just watched the whole thing unfold. And then about, you know, 10 minutes after the truck, he just turned to me and he said, Barbara, how is it that you're able to do that? And I said, Victor, you know what? It is not me doing it. It is just me listening. It's them doing it. And I said, because I know that they exist without a doubt, they know they can give me a message and I will follow it. I believe in them. I understand that they're there. Whether it be God, whether it be source, whether it be angels, whether it be soul guides, I have no idea. It's all beautiful, one big, big, beautiful picture for me. And I don't have to have names for them, and I don't need to know who they are, but I trust them completely. And I know they exist. And so for me, it's just listening and paying attention to what they tell me. And that's all everybody needs to do. If everybody did that, wow. You know, I think it'd be a different world out there.
They're really looking after you.
They are. I couldn't believe that they did that night. And Victor was like, I can't believe what I just saw. That was just, he said, if I had not watched that unfold personally, he said, having been married to you for 25 years and knowing that you don't lie and that you are, you know, honest to the nth degree, he said, I wouldn't have actually believed that story from you. He said, I had to live through that myself to actually see that unfold, to have that unfold was such a miracle. I said, I can't even put it into words. He said, I don't even know what to say. That was amazing. So it was just, you know, that's what happens sometimes. And I think we all have that possibility when we maybe hear, don't go down that alleyway, you know, or, you know, slow down as you're approaching that intersection, you know. And people say there's stories all the time on, you know, YouTube or whatever, where they say, I was going through an intersection. All of a sudden, I felt like I needed to stop at a you know, yellow light, or even wasn't even changed yet. And then somebody went plowing through the intersection and I would have been hit, you know. So there's, I think we're getting, you know, help from the other side a lot, but we just have to believe and understand that they're there. And then, you know, for me, it's, I don't mind whether anybody calls it God. I believe it's God. And I also believe it's Source. And I also believe it's angels. And I also believe it's soul guides. And I believe, you know, I believe it all. I think they're all there. And so it, to me, it doesn't have to have a name. It just is a beautiful source of power and love. And they try to help us. And so I believe and I listen. So I think everybody did.
Well, can you tell us, are there any figures for how many people have near-death experiences?
Oh, yeah. The number of people who have near-death experiences is estimated. The only time there was an actual study that we know of was in 1982, and Gallup organization, G-A-L-L-U-P, they always do the Gallup polls. They did a big research thing at that time in 1982, and at that time they estimated 13 million adults had NDEs in the U.S. alone. Now, the current estimates are 1 in 20. 1 in 20 adults has had a near-death experience. Plus, you add on the children's NDEs on top of that. Because of those resuscitation efforts improving over the years, we're having more and more and more people just. And there are famous people. Elizabeth Taylor had one. There are a number of Hollywood people. If you just Google Hollywood NDEs, you'll see all of these amazing people that were, you know, superstars in Hollywood that have had them as well. And so I just think it's an amazing, amazing thing.
So there are a lot of people out there who are just not talking about it.
Absolutely.
It must be a cultural thing. They're scared to say it in case people think they're crazy.
Exactly, just as I was. And, you know, I was just flying. We had a weird experience. I was flying to Tucson, Arizona to talk there about my near-death experience. And on the way over on the plane and on the way back on the plane, I'm seated next to, you know, somebody on the seat next to me. And they asked, what are you doing? Why are you flying to Tucson? And I said, well, I'm going over to talk and I'm giving a speech over there. And they said, well, what is it about? And I said, well, I had a near-death experience. So I'm talking about my near-death experience. Oh my gosh, my mom had one. And the one on the way back said, oh, my brother had one. And so both people had absolutely a connection to a near-death experience, although they hadn't had them themselves. But if you go out and talk to people and open the question up, you know, what do you know about near-death experiences? You'll find that a lot of people that you know somebody or, you know, have some connection to it. So it's pretty awesome. I'm glad that this is opening up in the world. I think people will draw some really amazing things from understanding that death doesn't need to be feared and that our consciousness survives death. I was totally me up on that ceiling of that examination of that, you know, room that I was having my myelogram in. I was totally me up on that ceiling, the same as I was in my body, except for that body just seemed like a wetsuit down below. It just seemed like I just shed something that I didn't really need. I was still me.
Yeah. Is there any information where an NDE has happened and people in the room have seen something, maybe a haze over the body, or witnessed something where they saw the NDE as well?
Yes. Yes. Actually, Jeff Olson is an amazing friend of mine. He has written the book, I Knew Their Hearts. And he also wrote the book Beyond Mile Marker 80. And then he has a brand new book out called Knowing, which is already on Amazon a number one. And they're actually sold out of it. I'm waiting for my copy to come. So Jeff Olson was in a car accident with his wife and his two children. His about 7-year-old son survived the accident, but his about 2-year-old son died in the accident, as well as his wife. His wife died. When he was in the hospital and he'd been delivered to an emergency room, he had his arm had been ripped off and was being held only to his body by a couple of shreds of skin. So his arm had been almost entirely ripped off. So he's bleeding profusely through his arm. His legs had been crushed under, he had been shoved underneath the steering wheel, and both of his legs had been crushed. And in fact, one of them ended up being amputated above the knee. And the seatbelt had cut through his abdomen, and his intestinal tract had been cut and shredded in all these different places. So his whole entire body was spilling out his guts out of this big scar through the center there. So he's in the emergency room, 3 different teams are working on him. And there's a particular doctor that is over all 3 teams that is controlling the entire emergency room. That doctor and his assistant are there in the emergency room. And as that doctor was looking at the situation with how deep these injuries were for this man, he actually was thinking, this man is not going to survive. We're wasting our time on this. This is not going to happen. And he saw a woman, a vision of a woman who said to him, you need to keep working on him. He will survive. And it ended up many years, a couple of years, I don't know how many years later, 3, 4, 5, I don't know what it was. Jeff had written his book, and he ended up realizing that in his manuscript, he had included that doctor's name, and he realized he needed to get permission from that doctor before the book went to print. So he contacted that doctor in a far city where he had had the car accident at. He didn't live in this city where the accident occurred. And he asked the doctor if he could meet him for lunch. After he had lunch with the doctor, well, during the lunch, he ended up saying, you know, what, this is why I'm meeting with you. I've written a book about my near-death experience. The doctor ended up telling Jeff that he had seen his wife during the surgery in the operating room, and that his wife had said that he would survive. And Jeff's NDE is totally amazing. You've got to get his books, because holy Toledo, he had the full-blown, full-fledged everything. And he saw his child on the other side. He talked with his wife on the other side. So he came back to talk about this, and he travels and talks all over the world. And he is such an amazing human being. But not only did that doctor, when the doctor went back to the office that day after seeing Jeff for lunch, he mentioned it to his right-hand person, a woman who was a nurse for him. And she said, Oh my God, you saw her too? I saw her. I didn't want to say anything. So not only did the doctor, I think his name is Jeff O'Driscoll, not only did the doctor see Jeff's deceased wife, Jeff Olson's deceased wife, but his assistant, his nurse, saw her as well. So 2 people saw Jeff's wife. So that's pretty awesome. You know, I think that's pretty, yeah, Raymond Moody says that's definite collaboration when someone who's not having a near-death experience actually sees the the situation unfolding and sees a piece of that.
People around the world have near-death experiences. And in Western culture, people sometimes report seeing Jesus. But if the NDE is in India, they will report seeing a Hindu god. There's some kind of cultural influence from the country where they grew up.
Yes, I think so too. And I think the other side delivers to us what we're going to feel comfortable with in the afterlife. So if we believe, you know, XYZ, then we're going to see XYZ. But if we believe ABC, we're going to see ABC. That's why, you know, Dr. Mary Neal, who was a orthopedic surgeon in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, she was in a beautiful field on a rock, and she was talking with Jesus in her near-death experience. I had a spiritual figure, but they didn't identify themselves as Jesus or God or anything else. I just felt that because of the pressure of how big this being was, it felt to me like God, but I didn't name it God and say, hey, God, what's happening? I just, you know, everybody has this feeling of what's important to them and what they believe in. And I believe that comes through from the other side. I don't think that God is one religion. I think God is every religion. I think God is much bigger than religion. I think God is just amazing. So I just think that that's the reason why we all get these different pieces of it, is because, you know, there's they're trying, whoever that is on the other side is trying to make us feel comfortable with what our experience is.
Also, there are some people that have NDEs and they're not a happy experience. They can be quite distressing. Why do you think that is happening?
Yes, exactly. You know, I wish that I knew more about distressing NDEs, but I do know I looked up some information on the IN's website, and they're reported, they have common elements as well, but with the opposite emotional states. They're more into extreme fear or isolation or terror or anger, loneliness, confusion, and sometimes even torment or guilt. Eben Alexander had a piece of that. He was what he called the worm's eye view. He felt that he was in this muck, kind of thick mud, like almost it was. He also felt a like almost like a heartbeat of a beating sound, and he said he felt like he was in there forever, like there was just no world. He didn't know about his past. He didn't know who he was. It was like he was a cell. And he didn't feel terror, anger, but I think it probably was isolation feeling. And he said then like a little light feeling, a light kind of circled down and had beautiful, you know, he looked at it, he focused on this light that was kind of there. And when he did that, he went into another environment, which was this beautiful valley that was, you know, gorgeous and had all this greenery and water flowing. And so it was, I'm not sure why the distressing ones occur. Nancy Bush was a president of IANS years ago, and she's written a book about her distressing near-death experience. I'm sure it's available on Amazon. The most common features are usually pleasurable in a near-death experience, but in those distressing ones, they sometimes, you know, the acute awareness of non-existence or being completely alone and an absolute void comes through. And some of the people also report a hellish imagery and, you know, ugly or foreboding landscape and demonic beings. Who's to say that that isn't what they're expecting to occur because of how maybe they have been taught in their life about hell, and that that's what they're expecting because they feel that they haven't lived their life in a positive way. So maybe that's what the other side sees that they're expecting to receive, and that's what they receive. I don't know. I don't have the answer on that.
I wonder if that whoever or whatever is controlling the experience the person is having is purposefully giving them a distressing NDE, knowing full well they will return to their body.
Yeah.
So that they will change their behavior. It's like they're looking at them and saying,
It could be.
Know what you need for your life.
To change yourself so that you know, maybe don't make the same choices and things like that. So it could be, you know, something that helps them. I've heard that it is actually in some of the situations, not all, there's no all on any of these. It's not the same anywhere, but they're similar. And I've heard that some of the people who have had distressing NDEs have come back and said, you know, they made a big change in their life. Perhaps they, you know, began feeling that they needed to correct things that they had been doing that were somehow out of whack. Or maybe they started going to church or, you know, something. Who knows what they ended up doing, but it seems to make a change to some people in having one of those hellish type of NDEs. Yeah.
Also, there are people who go through a situation where they are close to death and they are resuscitated and do not report any kind of experience.
Yeah, that's about 80% of the people that have resuscitation don't have a near-death experience or don't recall it. And so it's only about 20% of people who are resuscitated. They've done studies on that, substantial studies, and found that, between, I would say, 15 and 20% of resuscitated patients actually have a near-death experience. One of the big studies they were doing was across three different countries. It was Dr. Pim van Lommel, who is a cardiologist in the Netherlands. He put photographs on top of machinery inside of the rooms that people would, you know, normally be resuscitated in, so that if someone was up on the ceiling, they would be able to see the odd photograph. Maybe it's of a poodle dog, or it's of some sort of a weird, you know, picture that the person could identify. And only about 15% of the people in those studies came back being able to identify having a near-death experience. And I think very few of them were able to actually connect with the photographs that had been, or state what the photographs were that were up above. So I didn't, you know, when I looked down and saw what was happening with my situation in my near-death experience, when I validated it, it scared everybody in the room when I told what had happened. So I'm pretty sure I was accurate with what had happened during the resuscitation while I was flatlining and dead. So, but everybody that comes back from a near-death experience doesn't have that opportunity to immediately validate their experience. And so doctors are now being asked to ask patients that are resuscitated, did anything happen to you while you were, you know, while you were out? Did you have any kind of an experience while you were out? And let the person talk about it. Because one of the things that Pim van Lommel, the doctor, reported was that he was at a big conference and it was about near-death experiences. And there were a number of people in the audience, both media and doctors and experiencers. And this one man stood up, and it was a doctor that had stood up and said, I don't believe that people had near-death experiences. I don't believe that that's real. And this other man that stood up and said, I'm your patient, and I had, you know, resuscitation with you, and I had a near-death experience, and you're the last person I would tell because you're the last person that would listen to me. And that's kind of how I felt with that one doctor that I had, that doctor. After I ended up having my near-death experience and I ended up being released from the hospital after the surgery, I had to go back to see him. And I was in his exam room and he walked in. It was about 2 weeks after the near-death experience and the surgery. And he walked in and he literally put his hand forward and his fingers spread out in like as far as fingers could spread out. He had like a stop motion. And he put it in front of my face and he said, don't even think that you can talk about what happened during your myelogram, because I am not going to discuss that with you. If you want to talk about that, go find yourself another doctor. So he actually, like 2 weeks after my near-death experience, it was so scary to him. He literally didn't want me to say one word about it in any way, shape, or form to him, no matter how much time passed. So he's obviously scared. Yeah, very scared about it. I hope that it planted a seed for him and that someday he'll understand.
That was an interview with Barbara Bartolome about her two near-death experiences. A great way to support the podcast is to join Patreon, where you'll get access to the extended episodes. The Patreon episodes are ad-free and are released 2 days before the free versions, and you can now sign up for a 7-day free trial. You can become a patron by going to patreon.com/ourparanormalafterlife, or click on the Patreon button on my homepage at pastliveshypnosis.co.uk. The links are in the show notes. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.